Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, December 19th, 2014. It's the Federal News Countdown. And every Friday, we count down the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. But this week is a very special week. It's the final countdown of 2014, the very last Federal News Countdown. I'm off next week and bringing the countdown back to celebrate its fifth anniversary, the first weekend, first Friday of 2015. My experts on the Federal News Countdown this week, Horace Blackman of Lockheed Martin. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in today.
Francis, always a pleasure.
And also have John Adler, the president of FLEO, the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. It's great to have you, my friend. Thanks
Same
for coming
here,
in.
Same here, Francis.
Another unique element of the Federal News Countdown this week is that you are both first-timers. So it's wonderful to have both of you on. I'm glad you're here. You've chosen great stories on the countdown. And we start the Federal News Countdown where we always do at... At
number three.
And Horace, your third most important federal news story of the week is from modernhealthcare.com. The headline is Patient Data Held for Ransom at Rural Illinois Hospital. Clay County Hospital in Flora, Illinois is only an 18-bed facility. What I took away from this piece, though, is that if you're a professional bad guy, this is the kind of place that you start and see if your ideas and your procedure work before you go after a bigger target. Am I on track
yeah,
there?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. So a couple things here, right? You know, what we're seeing is the need for information security is evolving. And where you thought that, you know, only big companies, big government agencies, and big organizations were susceptible to cyber attacks, we're seeing that small town hospitals are too. And what we're seeing is that the need to protect patient data, the need to protect personal health information and personally identifiable information that will lead to things such as identity theft and other malicious things are just as important in small town USA as it is in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, New York, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have a hospital in the middle of Illinois. You know, we have a hospital that is, you know, modernizing to the, you know, much like everywhere else, looking at maintaining their patient data on computer systems. They're potentially looking at things such as electronic health record to improve the efficiency and the delivery of healthcare services. And lo and behold, the thing that they have to pay just as much attention to is information security and their ability to protect the data they're collecting about their patients. So this is a big and important trend, not so much it's about this hospital. And a bunch of bad guys are trying to hold this hospital hostage, you know, and demand some money or if they will expose the data, I mean, the health information of these patients.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly there's a criminal element in that. I mean, John, certainly that's your end of the world. You know about this sort of thing. But it begins to tell you that not that the world is changing, the world has changed. And how we think about protecting our data, whether it's Target, whether it's a department store, whether it's our bank, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much as... it's something that the folks in big city America have to worry about. It's you and I.
Yeah.
It's the folks going in to get a checkup that have to worry about these things. Folks that may be delivering babies, whatever the case may be.
I'm really struck by that element of this. Clay County is in the middle of Illinois. I looked it up on Google Maps. It's not really close to anything. I mean, it's a fair distance, a couple hours drive from St. Louis. It's in that part of the state. So that means it's way far away from Chicago, where most people would think if you're going to go after a target, you go after a big target. But that's what makes me think it's the kind of thing where somebody's just practicing for trying to catch a bigger fish.
Well, one thing you can think about, it may be practice, or we may just be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may be at the point where small town hospitals, small town banks, small town institutions that collect data, run computer systems to deliver healthcare services are just as susceptible to being attacked and having their information put at risk as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that, you know, that's somebody else's problem, that as a small town hospital, I can't afford to spend money on information security. I can't afford to harden my endpoints. I can't afford to look at, you know, host intrusion protection systems and antivirus and all the things that can be completely dangerous, you know, to my operation. It's there. You're there, right? So we have to think about not so much the folks who are looking at whether you're protecting the Pentagon. The same dangers that exist in terms of the need to protect the information of the federal government, the banks, the insurance company, you know, Sony certainly is out there right now. That's been in the news. It applies to your small town hospital, as you say, in the middle of, I don't call anybody middle of nowhere in Illinois, but essentially in a pretty remote location.
Yes. The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Horace Blackman, is patient data held for ransom at rural Illinois hospital. John Adler, your third most important story of the week is from the Washington Post, and the headline is Obama commutes prison sentences for 8 and pardons 12. These are four people in this mix condemned to life in prison. All will get out next year. What does this say to you and your members about? I mean, these are the people that some of your members theoretically put where they are today for the president to turn around and let them out.
You know, there actually is some connection to what Horace was just speaking about as well. And what I'm concerned is this may set a trend so that these folks, these hackers who are engaging in all that type of criminal conduct, could be the next round of folks who are perceived as being relatively nonviolent, not necessarily having a gang affiliation, terrorist affiliation. They could be the lone wolf of the cyber world. And yet at some point, we may not want to waste our taxpayer dollars incarcerating them as well. I think we have to be very, very careful in terms of how we assess the situation. Now, I could see in here where, you know, the Deputy Attorney General sort of sets the criteria in how they would consider the clemency filings or applications. But I think that one should not be too quick to conclude that in sort of commuting a prison sentence for a drug offender, whether there it's possession or it's an intent to distribute, that the fact that they don't have any violent or known violence in their history, they're peddling dope, they're peddling the devil. And they themselves may not be imminently violent, but they're going to cause others to become violent. They're mm-hmm. going to cause people to attack law enforcement officers, good citizens, desperate people who need money to buy crack, to buy coke, to buy meth, to buy heroin. And I think that we sort of need to take a broader look at this, trust our prosecutors to make the correct discretionary decision, our investigators working with them. You know, the other thing to consider is if we let these folks out, are we inherently dumping a federal problem onto state and local law enforcement? So on the one hand, we could say, well, yeah, these folks aren't necessarily violent, so let's let them out. But alternatively, is there going to be any behavioral change? Are they going to now sort of stray away from the drug business, or are they going to go back to what they unfortunately only know how to do to make a living? Mm-hmm. And now it becomes a state and local problem. So how does that ultimately save us resources as a country? So I think it really requires deeper thought, and I think we could be really rushing into a bad thing for the purpose of saving money and, of course, couching it as, you know, sort of equity in terms of sentencing. But there's more to it than that.
You mentioned the Deputy Attorney General James Cole making a statement about these releases, and in that statement, as quoted in the Post, he said, for our criminal justice system to be effective, it needs to not only be fair, but it also must be perceived as being fair. What do you think he means by that? I think I understand, but those...
Yeah, no, he makes a valid point that applies to just about anything, which is sometimes the perception of anything trumps the reality. So outside looking in, if there is a general sense among the American public that their taxpayer dollars are going to incarcerate people wrongly and extensively, well, then it requires and it justifies a closer look. So I'm with him in terms of recognizing the perception, but I think the answer is delve deeper into that perception. What causes it, and what are your options? Not mm-hmm. just simply to go ahead and allow for the submission of a pile of these requests for clemency. You know, the other add-on piece, because a lot of this is cost-driven, and we also need to consider how much of this cost is now transferred to probation and pretrial offices who now have to deal with this group as, you know, offenders who are being or released, but under their supervision. There's a tremendous cost, and that's also something that we have to consider because they don't have the necessary staffing and resources to oversee their current group of offenders. I think you talk to the average probation officer, they'll tell you they're overwhelmed, that their case inventories are as high as ever. So I think we need a deeper dive into this, not just the perception per se, but the finances and the precedent it could be setting.
There are three requirements for these commutations and pardons. Low-level offenders with no significant criminal history or ties to gangs must have served at least 10 years in prison and would have gotten lesser punishments had they been sentenced today. So these are folks, especially with the 10 years of prison requirement, these are folks who have served some portion of a debt to society. and have undergone some pretty high level of punishment. Are there some of these crimes, though, that as you look at them through a law enforcement lens, regardless of the mitigating circumstances, whatever they may be, that the Deputy Attorney General and the President wound up signing off on, that maybe just aren't good enough to warrant release in these cases?
Yeah, it helps in full disclosure to see actually the particulars for each of these cases. You know, we're drawing upon an article that gives us a number, I think, of 8, but it doesn't tell us about each of the cases. Mm-hmm. If you have somebody who's incarcerated in life in prison for smoking pot, yeah, something's wrong with that,
right,
and it needs to be addressed. Alternatively, if you have somebody who's involved in trafficking a serious amount of narcotic, but they themselves haven't been in any fights in prison, or they haven't been known to be affiliated with a cartel or a gang or a terrorist organization, it doesn't mean that they aren't violent or capable of violence or causing others by virtue of their involvement in a business. Let me tell you something. Drug trafficking, that's a violent business. Mm-hmm. People die. People get killed in that business. So it's not necessarily sufficient to say that that individual themselves doesn't have a direct link. You know, we use the term lone wolf when we talk about people who commit acts of terrorism, but we can have a lone wolf, if you will, drug trafficker who is incredibly or potentially violent and dangerous, but it just may not be there in print in terms of any known gang affiliation.
John Adler's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Obama commutes prison sentences for 8, pardons 12. You can find it and all of the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John and Horace on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Horace Blackman and John Adler. And we are up to
number 2.
And the second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Adler, is from Fox News. The headline is Indiana cop asked to stop selling Breathe Easy shirts. This is a takeoff on the I Can't Breathe shirts that we see. It seems like just about every athlete in the United States is wearing. Georgetown University's basketball team is the latest that I heard about. There are probably others that have been more recent than that. What's the significance that you see here? The message on these shirts, breathe easy, don't break the law. Police officer Jason Barthel selling these T-shirts.
Yeah, the significance I see is above and beyond the obvious, which is an alternative message on a shirt. In effort to deal with and address a very serious or a group of very serious issues. On the one hand, as someone who represents law enforcement, I feel we haven't had the opportunity to engage in meaningful forums to share our voice, to share our concerns on several of the issues related to the Ferguson situation, the Staten Island situation, and others where The unarmed man mythology, as I call it, is really sort of casting all of us in a very negative light. And we don't think that the law enforcement perspective is sort of being invited into any national discussion. But the bigger issue here is, so what do we have? We have professional athletes, as you said, who are coming on to the court, and they're wearing a shirt with one statement. And then we have a local police officer wearing a shirt with another statement, a contrary perspective. So in the end, do we become a country of who has the better T-shirt is right? Folks, we need some leadership on this. This is a very hot topic. People are out there protesting. They could be missing work to protest. So the answer is, where is our national leadership to bring the parties together in a professional forum where people can express their views intelligently? Yeah, this is very emotional, but both sides need to come together. And isn't that what our country is all about? We should not be reduced to a battle of the T-shirts. We should bring everyone together, as challenging and emotional as the topic is. Let's flush this out and try and do something. T-shirt warfare, we're not going to accomplish anything. And I said that if this is what we have to resort to, and I think this is what this is saying in effect is, law enforcement needs a voice. That's what that shirt is telling me. Irrespective of the message, we need a voice in a national discussion, and it ain't there.
I do not mean to minimalize the effort that this police officer is making, nor the protesters who have a different set of beliefs. But the parallel that I saw, Horace, was with President Obama's speech today about the response to the Sony hack. This was an issue of also of great national importance economically. The report I read this morning estimated the infrastructure costs alone around $300 million to go back and secure this infrastructure that Sony has been compromised by them. And then the broader concept is we have somebody, another country essentially, deciding what they think should and shouldn't be released in our country. And it's just the parallel that I see, John, is all voices from all over the place with not as much clarity about what actually winds up happening in the long run.
So information security and the ability to protect information is not so much just something you do to make sure your information doesn't get out there. Increasingly, we're seeing this is a national security matter. This is a in some instances, a criminal matter. Mm-hmm. This is an issue of safeguarding assets, information assets, physical assets, actual hardware, and it actually can do a lot of damage because you know we've seen instances, certainly certain Sony hack where hardware is actually destroyed and mm-hmm. rendered unusable.
Yeah.
Certainly we have damage there. We have actually seen instances in the past where there's actually been theft. I mean, we talked previously about folks potentially holding things hostage. So certainly there's a law enforcement and criminal element to these stories that we sometimes lose in the mix. But, you know, let's kind of think back to sort of when you think about another country conducting something like this, we really begin to think in terms of how do we defend our nation from the ability to someone to essentially, I don't want to use the word wage war, but mm-hmm. really conduct operations to us against us that could be damaging and potentially harmful to our infrastructure, to our information security apparatus, and really to safeguard a lot of the things that we hold dear in terms of monetary things, in terms of our information, in terms of the things that are necessary to go about living our lives.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and yeah, that's an excellent point. You know, we sort of embrace the spirit of the saying, we won't negotiate with terrorists, but are we negotiating with hackers? And are they doing the same thing? I mean, granted, we have the term cyber terrorism, but what is the takeaway from Sony? Now, we were concerned anytime we have an active shooter situation, we're concerned of the contagion effect, that some disenfranchised person will see that in the news and they will say, okay, this is my opportunity to take my dysfunctional mind and be noticed, be recognized. Mm-hmm. So now when we see this, whether it was the small town medical center we were just talking about or Sony, so isn't this, if nothing else, an invitation to other hackers to say, hey, let me get a crack at this. Let's see what damage I can do. Let's see how much we can cost a corporation or a government agency by a remote hacking job. And what is the response? How do we sort of ante up our game and get better prepared and capable, not just to prevent, but be able to respond to this timely? It's a challenge.
We just have a minute or so left, but that model could also apply to your story here, which is you could wind up with law enforcement officers in situations where they're dealing with people who are trying to put them in uncomfortable, provocative, confrontational, and high-profile situations to draw out exactly the kind of responses that we've seen to call attention to whatever their cause happens to be.
No, it's true. You know, so what is it the saying, the squeaky wheel gets the grease?
Yeah.
Well, we've got to be a little bit more, we got to have a little more depth than just the squeakiness. And we've got to be a little bit more methodical, a little bit better prepared in terms of how we respond to what we obviously know is here. It's not speculative, it's real.
John Adler's second most important federal news story of the week is from Fox News. Indiana cop asked to stop selling Breathe Easy shirts. Horace, your second most important story of the week is from FedScoop. The headline is Health IT 2014 Interoperability, Ebola, and Healthcare.gov 2.0. The piece here begins with a data quote from Todd Park, who was the chief technology officer back in May, speaking at my favorite title of an event in the federal government, the 2014 Health Data Palooza, was what that event was called. And he talks about the concept of universal availability of data for the person whose data it is, with consumers and so on, should be able to access their own data and all of that. What have we learned since May, and what do you expect us to continue to learn when it comes to being able to access our own information and information that can help us to stay healthier?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, Francis, I mean, there are a lot of information that's stored about you, right? There's your credit information, there's your insurance information, banks collect a lot of information about you, and historically, we've seen attempts to give you the ability to see what those that information is collected about you, understand the impact of that information, understand how it's being used. There's actually laws on the books that govern this sort of thing. Health information is really how we're thinking about health information may very well be how we thought about credit information 30, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thinking in terms of what information is out there that my doctor has collected, what lab results are out there that I may have, what sorts of things that are being collected, you know, whether it's a wearable device, whether it's output from a health medical devices or what have you. There's a lot of things that are being collected about you. So I think the topic, and you mentioned Todd Park in the Health Data Palooza event that was held back in May. It's really beginning to open a conversation about how we should think about it and how this information should be governed,
mm-hmm.
What sorts of regulatory frameworks ought to be put in place to manage this, and how do we interact and how should we think about the health data and the vast array of information that exists about us, how that's collected, what sort of rights do we have,
mm-hmm.
right? And what kind of portability do we have from provider to provider, from government agency to government agency, whether it's the VA, whether it's DOD, what have you. I think it's an important conversation to begin. This conversation is already happening at a variety of different levels across the spectrum, and I think we're going to see more of this continue.
The idea of thinking about health data the same as we used to think about financial data, as Horace alluded to, John, means that at some point somebody's got to think about the legal framework around it and what kind of policies and laws should be in place to protect people from that information getting around. I certainly don't want somebody to have my Social Security number, for example. And just as much, I'm not sure I want somebody just walking down the street to be able to have access to my personal health information. What are the ramifications for people in the law enforcement business for reacting to these things that are relatively new on the horizon and figuring out how to move forward on them?
Yeah, the challenge is that, you know, we're evolved past that stereotypical bad guy for you old folks like me, Popeye, right? So Popeye was Pluto or Brutus, whichever period you might have watched the show. You know, the heavyset guy who didn't shave in a couple of days. You know, now we have this sort of phantom bad guy or bad guys out there. We can't see them. So cyber cases tap our resources. They take a lot of time. They're sophisticated. And if we were to be overrun or overwhelmed with cyber cases, well, obviously the saying you can't borrow from Peter to pay Paul, how do we shift our law enforcement assets effectively that we address this absolute priority, you know, in terms of a crime wave and yet still cover all our other mission components as well? You know, and the big thing here is, and I guess maybe it sort of overlaps with the issues we've talked about, which is we struggle to protect the consumer's information and also maintain their confidence. You know, Target went through this, Home Depot went through this. It makes you take pause and say, hey, you know what? Maybe I'd rather go to the store, contrary to what we were talking about, Christmas shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I don't want to give my credit card information online because I'm not sure, number one, how well they'll protect it. And number two, what's that small print that says my information won't be peddled out to someone else? So maybe the small print requirement needs to be at a larger font. Maybe we need some sort of confidence that they do have the proper cyber protocols in play so that anyone with a kindergarten level knowledge of hacking can't just go steal it. But it does need to be looked at proactively. We can't simply allow ourselves to be victims repeatedly before we finally recognize it as a priority.
The thing about this story, Horace, that jumped out at me is the fourth or fifth paragraph. A recap of health IT in 2014 wouldn't be complete without mentioning a few of the biggest stories of the year that had some health IT implications. The Department of Veterans Affairs waitlist scandal, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and healthcare.gov's second go-around. Now, obviously, there was not as much controversy around the second open season for healthcare.gov as there was around the first. But I can't remember very well back to this time a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, but I would bet dollars to donuts there weren't three major health IT stories at the end of the year that were on our plates like there are right now.
You know, from the health IT perspective this year, it's been what a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just been, think about all the things that's happened. And I'll even throw some more in there, right? We certainly had challenges in terms of scheduling and looking at the challenges with the scheduling system of the VA. Mm-hmm. Certainly we had issues there. And we're looking at what does that mean in terms of a transformative approach of how we do medical scheduling, not just within the VA, but across the spectrum. That puts some lights on that. We also thought, you know, certainly Ebola, but we forgot about MERS, which kind of came and went, right?
Yeah.
Certainly the CDC is actually in some shape or form actively responding to three epidemic outbreaks.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we know about Ebola. We know about the impact there. We know about the Middle East respiratory syndrome. And there's also, people forget, they're still fighting polio. We had an epidemic polio outbreak that's been under watch by CDC for about 39 months now or thereabouts. Then you get into the Affordable Care Act, and it's the second time we've gone around. The good news there is the second time may have been the charm. You know, we've seen a much different rollout of that effort. We've seen the systems perform much better, and it's really become, I wouldn't call it quite a non-issue, but certainly it's been a success, if you will, this time around. So there are a lot of, this has been a year that's highlighted the need to focus on health IT. You're seeing a lot of initiatives come out of this year based on some of the things you're talking about. Certainly on the federal health IT procurement front, there's some big ones out there. Certainly the VA is putting out the T4 next generation vehicle. There's the Defense Health Modernization System, DHMSM, and there's a variety of other things out there that's driving it. So the growth that's been generated from the things you mentioned not just makes this year an important year, but it's really made the next few years, the results you're going to see, whether it's a new scheduling system at the VA, it's going to beg the difference. So how do you then look at how to enable interoperability between VA, DOD, and those systems in the private sector? It opens up this conversation of the importance of information, IT systems and IT initiatives and a strategy around this topic that's going to stretch beyond this year.
Horace Blackman's second most important federal news story of the week is from FedScoop, Health IT 2014, Interoperability, Ebola, and Healthcare.gov 2.0. You can find all the stories on the countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Horace Blackman and by John Adler on the Federal News Countdown.
Salvation Army bells this Christmas, know you are doing the most good to feed and to shelter your neighbors.
After having no place to go, the Salvation Army took me in. The Salvation Army is helping me turn my life around.
When you hear bells this holiday season, please support the Salvation Army's mission to feed and shelter our neighbors in D.C., Maryland, and Northern Virginia.
We are the Salvation Army of the National Capital Area, doing the most good.
Here's Don Adcock, Acting Chief Information Officer at the Department of Energy, on the Cloud-Driven Data Insights in Government panel discussion sponsored by Microsoft.
What you get out of a cloud solution, which is, you know, huge space and storage abilities and the ability to move quickly, and then the data analytics tools coupled in that environment, you really start harnessing the power of what we're trying to get to and what we really need to drive both business and back office decisions.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com/onecloud.
The Microsoft Cloud for Government is the perfect match for federal government services. With tools like Microsoft Office 365, Microsoft Azure, and Dynamics CRM Online, discover how the Microsoft Cloud for Government provides cost savings, rigorous security located in U.S. data centers, and hybrid capability with an integrated open platform, all from one trusted source. Become familiar with the Microsoft Cloud for Government, and you'll be prepared to move towards the future today. Visit Microsoft.com/government. Microsoft.com/government.
Previously on the Industrialized, Interoperable, and Insight-Driven Federal Health Panel, sponsored by Accenture, Dr. Bart Harmon, President, Clinical Informatics Expert, said,
"The need for interoperability across DOD, VA, and the commercial health space has increased significantly since about 2003. It's been important for a long time, but the need has really escalated because of the nature of the injuries, the survivability. The need for interoperability is remarkably different now than it was before 2003.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com/onecloud.
It's 2025. The U.S. has saved nearly $1 trillion in federal expenditures. Sound impossible?
Increasing government efficiency by just 1% each year can make it happen. And Accenture is helping by implementing cost-saving strategies across three key areas: workforce, technology, and mission support. Accenture has helped one federal agency save more than $125 million annually. That's high performance delivered. Visit Accenture.com/government efficiency to learn more.
Take your real estate career to the next level. Earn your graduate degree at the University of Maryland's nationally renowned Colvin Institute of Real Estate Development. Learn more at ColvinInstitute.org.
Management Friday on Federal News Radio. Friday mornings at 10, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum host Women of Washington. Hear from Washington, D.C.'s ambitious and influential female executives, role models for the next generation Washington leader. Then at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch to learn the best career path for you. Management Friday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com, the Federal News Countdown featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week, selected this week by Horace Blackman and John Adler, and we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Horace Blackman, is from federalnewsradio.com. It's my colleague Jason Miller's story, VA bringing latest cyber tools to bear to improve network defenses. Not that you're biased toward VA at all, since you only spent, what, the last how long of your career there?
About 6 years.
Yeah, and you've only been out for, what, about a year or so you've been
about 9 months.
Okay. So you might be a little bit biased, but this is essentially what I took away from this when Jason reported it was Steph Warren responding, I think, very forcefully and very deliberately to a lot of the concerns that the Government Accountability Office has raised about VA's IT posture and also that the VA's Inspector General's Office has raised. And he's being pretty proactive about it, it seems to me, and pretty deliberate, also very transparent, talking about the steps that he expects
absolutely
to take.
So you know, we started this show by talking about a small-town hospital in the middle of Illinois that was held hostage and potentially by information security folks, hackers, and potentially putting at risk hospital data from a small town hospital in Illinois. You know, we talked about things going on at the enterprise level in terms of health interoperability at, you know, DHS, fight against Ebola, et cetera. So here we are, the second largest department in the federal government. And we talked about Sony. We talked about a number of other things here. So it's like we've worked our way up to sort of the biggest fish here, right? This is a large department. This is the one part of the federal government that's in every single state. It's in most U.S. territories, Guam, Philippines, Virgin Islands, et cetera. You got 340,000 employees. At one point, they had over 600,000 devices. And that number may actually be going up, right? When you add in the fact that 70% of all clinicians in the United States at some point in their career are rotated through the VA, work there, or train there, you're seeing how important this is. So the fact that they're looking and proactively taking on this challenge of addressing the information security issues that they may have over there is, I mean, I absolutely applaud them. I think this is an important step. And I think looking at embracing some of the cutting-edge tools you're seeing, the Einstein 3A tools that DOD is really pushing, looking at how they're integrating and embracing solutions that are coming from the private sector, from information security, internet security provider, and internet service providers, I should say, ISPs. I think it's a novel approach. Now, this comes on top of an initiative they had over there called CRISP, the Continuous Readiness and Information Security Program, which is focused on identifying and addressing challenges you have. But as you know, we've talked before, what you're seeing within the VA, and it's the same anywhere else, is this disaggregation between the device and the data. So they're looking to really encrypt and protect data that is increasingly stored away from the device. But at the same time, you've got to protect the devices. Mm-hmm. So really, it's looking at endpoint protection. How do you go beyond simply antivirus and host intrusion protection software products to really understanding the true vulnerabilities of each one of those devices, whether it's 300,000, 600,000, what have you. These things are becoming hyper portable. They're becoming smaller. They're much easier to leave these things on the metro. You know, back in the days when you had a luggable, a giant, you know, laptop and a briefcase, it was pretty, you kind of knew if you had it or not.
Yep.
These days when we tout the fact that your iPhone may only weigh 6 ounces, you know, tell me if you're six ounces lighter,
mm-hmm.
right? So the work that's being done there is actually being done in conjunction with some pretty important things. They're rolling out 60,000 iPads and iDevices and tablets so the clinicians can use this. So as you're trying to protect these things, the things you have to protect are multiplying in numbers tremendously. What the patients, what the clinicians, and what your end users are looking for, the demands aren't going down, they're going up.
Mm-hmm.
And the complexities of protecting these things is a job that is actually becoming harder by the minute, not mm-hmm. by the day.
John, the story, as my colleague Jason Miller writes, it says Warren, the CIO at VA, Steph Warren, said he could make the most secure system by unplugging it and burying it in a lead box 6 feet underground, but that wouldn't help the veterans. And that's true. From a law enforcement and a security perspective, are we starting to see, do you think, a recognition that intrusions are going to happen, cyber breaches are going to happen the same way as in the real world, people rob grocery stores and people commit other crimes that they shouldn't commit?
Absolutely. You know, as someone who grew up on a telecommunications system consisting of two cups and a string, yeah, we definitely have evolved to a point where you know, the absolute need to get more sophisticated in the technology we use to protect our assets, information is critical. And certainly, you know, it is, it's sort of a dance. We've got to marry or dance partners of technology and those using it. And sometimes we have a slow dance, sometimes we have freestyle. But I think a lot of it also is making sure the employees themselves are aware of the vulnerabilities and what may cause them. Because each employee has access to their own computer or their laptop, which could create a vulnerability based on what they do at their laptop. You know, I think the VA police, the OIG guys, they do a great job protecting the physical infrastructure, the veterans themselves. But this is actually a very important article. I mean, I agree with Horace that there's an absolute need, again, to ensure that all the protective barriers are in play. The folks know how to use them, you know, the end users. And the other point that Horace brought up, and we saw this with DHS and other components, is these external hard drives, these devices used to store personnel data and other important information, they're vulnerable. So whether it's an employee with bad intentions or just simply negligence, and somehow these external hard drives, they disappear. And the next thing you know, we've got rampant identity theft for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of innocent employees, and we need to bring our A game. We need to protect this like Fort Knox protects gold. And the way to do it is investing in it like the VA apparently is doing to make sure the cyber protections are there.
Horace Blackman's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jason Miller's story, VA bringing latest cyber tools to bear to improve network defenses. That story and all of our stories on the Federal News Countdown are linked now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, John Adler's choice number one to wrap up the Federal News Countdown next. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, the Federal News Countdown, the last one of 2014, with Horace Blackman and John Adler choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week. And John, your choice at number one is from the Hill newspaper. The headline is Historically Unproductive Congress Ends. And it's not in the headline, but I wonder if we might insert the word mercifully in the headline, because this story details some of the numbers about how little work was done. I got to say, I talk to a lot of people that are maybe cynically happy, but happy nonetheless, that at least they left town with appropriations bills in place, except for one agency. It's a pretty important one, Homeland Security. But most of the government funded for the rest of the fiscal year. No worries about a shutdown. Nobody expecting that to happen when they come back. Maybe they didn't get a lot done, But they left a lot more certainty, it seems, than they've left the last couple of times that they've closed out either for the year or for an entire Congress. Am I off base there, do you think? Or
no, you've got a good lead on the base, but you're not necessarily off it. You may get caught stealing. But I think the concern, you know, the article goes more towards the few number of laws that were passed. I don't necessarily agree with that. It's quality, not necessarily quantity. The thing that really resonates with us, well, number one, as a federal government employee, they shut the government down. So that in and of itself reeks as failure to me. You know, we can all agree to disagree. We're civil, and that's what our country is built on. But they shut the government down. In addition to that, it seems like anything that had the word reform attached to it went nowhere. It just stalled out in the gate. You know, we're left with, you know, you mentioned, Francis, a little thing like Homeland Security and the appropriations not there. I mean, if the Department of Homeland Security is something meaningful, like keeping the citizenry safe, yet we move forward with the anxiety and insecurity as to whether or not there will be funding for it or just a continuation of the sort of low level of funding from the prior year or years, it's unacceptable. You know, that's not responsible governing. And, you know, you really need to roll up your sleeves and address these things timely. You don't wait to the close of the session. Now all of a sudden, okay, we'll put in a couple of extra hours, we'll roll up our sleeves, we'll take care of tax extenders and what I call the crumny bus, and then you just leave feeling good about yourself, ho, ho, ho. That's not responsible legislating. You know, understandably, there are different points of view on many issues, but you ultimately stay at the table and you work to resolve them for the betterment of the country.
Well, to be fair, I'm not sure they feel really good about themselves. I think there are a lot of people that left town this time thinking we have been screwing it up and we need to do it differently when they come back. And I guess that'll be the proof will be in the pudding, Horace, whether we see a different kind of operation, not just because Republicans are taking over the Senate as well as holding on to the House, but just because I wonder if maybe we're not misreading the results of this past election, and the results of the election really indicated that the average American citizen wants to see the government work better, and this was the change that they thought they could make in order to try to make that happen.
Well, let's take a different take on this, right? I mean, I think sometimes when we think about the government, we think about how things work, I think we get caught up, you know, within the political debate at a certain level. But let's kind of take it a couple levels down. You know, the government's about the nurse who's delivering, you know, medical exams at a VA hospital. It's about that soldier who is guarding a post. It's about the folks who are delivering your mail. And if we think about what is going on in terms of those services, you know, those services are going to continue to go on. Certainly, you had a shutdown, certainly, but even in that instance, there was the disruption to citizen services was minimized. So I think from the perspective that we've got to look at it is to think in terms of what does government do for each one of us in our lives? And for the most part, I think we are seeing that the services that are being delivered by the VA, by a lot of the other federal agencies, whether it's GSA, whether it's Department of Commerce, Air Traffic Control System, DHS, the folks checking you at the airport, those services continue to go on. Certainly, Congress has a duty to do, and certainly the way we get things done, you know, we have a three-legged stool in terms of our government, and it works. I think from the perspective of is one working well or is one certainly not working, we can have a debate about that. But I think what makes sense, and I think what we need to sort of maybe focus on in the larger context of the debate is how does government impact the lives of each and every one of us on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing is that those services that are delivered are continuing to get better. They're consistently delivered. And we really haven't seen any materially detrimental impact to those. So from that perspective, I'm pretty hopeful. When I look at the folks, the 2 million folks at the Department of Defense and the folks at the VA and the folks across government who go to work every single day and do a great job, I see a lot of hope in what they're doing, and I'm certainly optimistic in terms of what they've done this past year, these past 2 years, and what they're going to do in the next couple of years coming.
John, we just have a minute or so left. What would be, in your view, at the end of calendar 2015 or at the end of the 114th Congress, a good measure to use? I take your comment to heart that it's quality, not quantity, of bills and laws that Congress passes. I think that's a great point. But what's a good measure to use that they've done more, worked harder than what we've seen in the last couple of Congresses?
I think if you take it from a business perspective, you should have clearly stated objectives up front, and then we'll have a scorecard at the end of the year as to what objectives were accomplished. Mm. You know, from my law enforcement perspective, I can tell you that things are getting increasingly difficult. Staffing levels are down, I hear, from agency directors to that of the 1970s. If they don't sustain the funding, if we don't have the resources, we're going to be even at greater jeopardy, not just to cyber crimes, but border issues. And that's one in particular. The immigration border issue remains unresolved. They need to get to the table and resolve that. It's not a simple problem, mm-hmm. but the priority is there. So I think in the end, we need to see a fair professional commitment from all parties involved to address these issues timely. Don't wait for the end of 2015 to make your scorecard look pretty. Do it every day. And when you have to work late, work late. But ultimately, come to a resolution and work it out.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Adler, is from the Hill newspaper, Historically Unproductive Congress Ends. All the stories from the countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. John Adler of FLIOA, great to have you on the countdown. Nice job in your debut performance. And I hope you have a great holiday.
You too, Francis.
Thank you very much. Horace Blackman of Lockheed Martin, same. Thanks for coming on the program. And the Federal News Countdown returns the first Friday of January 2015. Thanks very much for listening.
WFED Washington.